On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the news this week, change, change, change for JetBlue.
This is a defining moment in our company. This is something that we have learned a painful lesson. And because it has been so painful, and had this storm gone on for 1 or 2 days, I'm not sure, I know we wouldn't be the company that we're going to be in the future.
For the war in Iraq.
The actual reduction in forces will be from the present 7,100, itself down from over 9,000 2 years ago, and 40,000 at the time of the conflict, to roughly 5,500.
For the tone of the 08 presidential race.
I sure don't want Democrats or the supporters of Democrats to be engaging in the politics of personal destruction.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind this week's headlines. We have a terrific panel with us today from Washington, Jill Lawrence, national political correspondent for USA Today. She's just back from Culver City, Nevada, where she covered the Democratic Candidates Forum. Jill Lawrence, nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Also in Washington, David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post. He is just back from Berlin and Russia and writes today about the signals from Tehran. David, good to have you.
Hello, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Jack, as always, great to have you.
Hello, Jane, Jill, and David.
I want to start by going around the table first off. Top story of the week. Jill Lawrence, let's begin with you.
Well, the 08 campaign is obviously off and running, and the Nevada forum was the kickoff for the major candidates to appear. And it was a lot more interesting than it could have been for a lot of reasons. One of them was this, what George Stephanopoulos called a press release scuffle between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, which kind of overshadowed the forum, especially since Hillary Clinton had to address it during the forum. And so we had the setting, which was the West, which signifies the Democrats' intent to make a go for the West and where they see the key to winning the White House back. And we had Iraq, which dominated the forum. And that also, Hillary Clinton was a target for that also. John Edwards took some shots. And so, and then we also had this David Geffen situation where the two leaders of the PAC, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, ended up scuffling over remarks he made about the Clinton years in the White House and raised some fears among Democrats who wonder if Hillary Clinton is too polarizing to win, and raised some questions about where Hollywood money is going to go.
We'll hear clips from that in just a moment. So, Jill, you have Political Forum in Nevada as your number one pick. David Ignatius, Washington Post, what about you?
Well, I thought this was a week when the showdown with Iran over its nuclear program really moved into a different gear. The International Atomic Energy Agency reported, as expected, that Iran is still not complying with UN demands that it alter its nuclear program. And interestingly, Secretary of State Rice was able to get what I'm told by her people is a tentative pledge from Russia and China to support a second round of sanctions against Iran. This comes as against a background, as I wrote in the Washington Post this morning, of signs that Iran may be blinking, that all of the pressure that the U.S. and its allies have been bringing on the nuclear issue may be bearing some fruit, in the sense that the Iranians are signaling all over the world through different intermediaries that they would like to resume negotiations about how to remove sanctions and in some way bring their program back under control. So I thought that was a big deal. You know, I thought that the Democrats were fascinating, but I have to say the events that Jill was describing ended up making me think that in this scramble for money early in the race, everybody ended up looking bad. I mean, I thought Obama looked bad. I thought Clinton looked bad. Mm. I thought Geffen looked bad. It was not a great week for the Democrats, as far as I was concerned.
David, thank you. Jack Beatty, your pick for the week.
Well, today's New York Times just had me. I mean, they show really how we are being played by this Shiite government. It's a story, one of several now, about how the Shiite police who we're going on these patrols with are laying back. We're doing the patrolling. We outnumber them. In fact, that the Times point story points out some of these Shiite policemen go ahead and warn people, hide your weapons. And this comes the week when Prime Minister Maliki really, I think, almost irreparably revealed the sectarian basis of his government in this about this his handling of this rape case. This woman, an unprecedented thing in the Muslim world, went on television and talked about her arrest and raped by Shiite security forces.
She's a Sunni.
Mm. And his reaction to this is, oh, she's a wanted person. She's made this up. This is all false. And it talk about a polarizing incident. And, of course, the Americans are still investigating it, and they're not backing his position at all. The document that he claimed substantiated the idea that she had made it up, the New York Times says it does not do that at all. He's just a totally sectarian response on this volatile, volcanic issue. And that, coupled with the with what we see about how this surge is playing out, the surge is essentially we are being used as a spear by the Shiite government against the Sunnis. And the Wall Street Journal today reports that Ahmad Chalabi, of all people, is back in the picture. Mm. And he's being appointed the point man for the Shiite government in you know, housing allowances and so on for the Sunni neighborhoods. And almost certainly there'll be corruption there and an anti-Sunni campaign by him. Mm. Further evidence that we are simply being played by that government.
Jack Beattie, thank you. Let's go back to the top, talk a little bit more about politics for the moment. Nevada hosting its first presidential forum, as Jill Lawrence mentioned, this week. Now a player in presidential politics after moving its caucus up between Iowa and New Hampshire. And this slugfest between Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, with David Geffen, media mogul, in the middle of it. I want to play a clip from part of that. Moderator George Stephanopoulos of ABC News asked Hillary Clinton about these critical comments made by David Geffen, who wants to raise millions of dollars for Bill Clinton and now supports Barack Obama.
Your campaign has gotten in a bit of a press release scuffle with the Obama campaign today, and it began with comments that David Geffen, who sponsored a fundraiser for Senator Obama, made in the New York Times today, critical of you and President Clinton. Your campaign has put out a press release calling on Senator Obama to denounce those remarks. Do you personally believe that Senator Obama should denounce David Geffen's remarks? And more generally, do you think that candidates, all the candidates, should be held accountable for the statements of their supporters and donors?
Well, I want to run a very positive campaign, and I sure don't want Democrats or the supporters of Democrats to be engaging in the politics of personal destruction. I think we should stay focused on what we're going to do for America. And, you know, I believe Bill Clinton was a good president, and I'm very proud of the record of his two terms.
Hillary Clinton saying she doesn't want to be engaged in the politics of personal destruction, and yet there was a ferocious response from her camp earlier. Jill Lawrence, is this indicative of the sort of slugfest we're in for in the months to come?
Well, I'm not sure, because Senator Obama's whole strategy is to try to remain above the fray, and he's now saying he didn't realize that his campaign had slugged back early in the day. What they said was that Hillary Clinton should renounce the support of a state legislator in South Carolina, an African-American, who had said that he was supporting Clinton because he thought that a ticket headed by Obama would doom all Democrats on the ticket because Obama's black. So that was a pretty pointed response, and he's now saying that he doesn't want to get into that sort of thing. He didn't know that was happening, and so it's unclear whether he's going to engage. But it was really quite striking at the forum. First of all, you had George Stephanopoulos, who used to work for Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, up there interviewing her. and then she uses the phrase the politics of personal destruction, and it was like time warp. You know,
right,
all of a sudden
right.
you're back in the era. You've got Hillary, you've got George Stephanopoulos, you've got the politics of personal destruction, and then the classic Bill Clinton strategy of let's not talk about us, let's talk about you, let's talk about what's good for America. So, I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of people it may have been a moment when they said, okay, you know, we have a choice to make. do we like what he did? Do we want his wife in the White House? Or do we not want to relive this?
Well, David Ignatius, speak to that a little bit. It raises questions about Bill Clinton, whether he's going to hurt or help Hillary in this campaign.
Well, I think that's one of the toughest issues she's going to have to deal with. It's hard to get your mind around the image of President Hillary Clinton and the role that former President Bill Clinton will play and what kind of presidency that will be. And I think she's going to have to speak to that, to see all these personalities from the Bill Clinton presidency surface in this flap over Geffen's role is just a reminder that's going to have to be sorted out. To me, this just showed how intense the early battle for money is going
That's
to
right.
be. I mean, this is going to be one heck of a slugfest. It's
right.
going to be an expensive slugfest. And, you know, I suspect that Hillary Clinton's people were angriest most of all that Geffen had held this million-dollar fundraiser for their key opponent before the Hillary Clinton campaign had really had a chance to hit Hollywood on its own.
Jack Beatty,
You know what struck me was David Geffen said what is simply the truth. I mean, he talks about everybody in politics lies, he said, but they do it with such ease, it's troubling. That's the truth about the Clintons. I mean, Mrs. Clinton, with her story about how the Rose Law Firm accounts just appeared in the White House. Oh, who knew where these were?
Back for a moment, panel, if you would, please, to Culver City, Nevada, for this week's Democratic presidential forum. I want to listen to a piece of sound from former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, who talked about health care reform and said that part of cutting costs is finding cures for diseases.
This is America. This is America. We can do great things. Let's pick out one or two diseases that are driving up health care costs, and let us challenge ourselves as Americans in the next decade to eradicate those diseases. We did that when I was a kid with polio, and we saved more money in the health care system than the entire cost of the health care system.
Jill Lawrence, USA Today. Were people interested? What was the response?
Well, this was a union audience, hundreds and hundreds of members of AFSCME, and they were extremely interested in health care. It was probably the one topic other than Iraq that really held everybody's attention. And all the Democrats want expanded or universal health care, and there were some interesting fault lines that opened up among the candidates. John Edwards has put out a very specific plan to get to universal care, and he wants to repeal some tax cuts on wealthier Americans and insists it's going to take new money to do this. And other candidates aren't so sure. Hillary Clinton wants universal care. She said that she plans to achieve it by the end of her second term. And she says we're already spending more than anyone else. We're already spending billions more, and she wants to look into ways of doing it without new money. Bill Richardson and Tom Vilsack want to expand the coverage without new taxes. And in fact, Bill Richardson laid down kind of a marker between himself and his party, saying that Democrats, the first solution shouldn't always be more taxes or more spending. So that was kind of an interesting indication of where he's going with his campaign.
You know, and this comes just as a Quinnipiac poll on Americans' attitude about health care came out, and a striking 53% of Americans said that they would pay higher taxes for government-subsidized health care, and 64% answered yes to the question, it's the government's responsibility to make sure everyone in the United States has adequate health care. That is a really striking finding, especially about the taxes, because hitherto polls have shown people, while they want universal insurance, they don't want to pay higher taxes. Here, 53 to 42, yes, we'll pay higher taxes for government-subsidized health care.
Interesting poll numbers, Jack Beatty. Thank you. I want to turn to Iraq now. On Wednesday, British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced he will order nearly half the British troops in Iraq home by the end of 2007 and assume a reduced role in the southern city of Basra.
What all of this means is not that Basra is how we want it to be, but it does mean that the next chapter in Basra's history can be written by the Iraqis.
Also, Vice President Dick Cheney told ABC News this week the British withdrawal is actually a sign of good news.
I look at it, and what I see is an affirmation of the fact that there are parts of Iraq where things are going pretty well. In fact, I talked to a friend just the other day who had driven from Baghdad down to Basra in 7 hours, found the situation dramatically improved compared to where it was a year or so ago, sort of validated the British view that they have made progress in southern Iraq. and that they can therefore afford to reduce their force levels.
David Ignatius from The Washington Post. Good news or further deterioration of the U.S. coalition?
Well, it's certainly deterioration of the coalition. I have sensed in Tony Blair over the last several months a desire really to declare independence from George Bush. His support for Bush really destroyed his prime ministership. He was a man of great promise, and his legacy really will be summed up in four letters, IRAQ. The situation in Basra, from what I read and hear, is quite ragged as different Iraqi Shiite groups fight for control there. And so to paint this as some kind of a success, I think misses reality. You know, this was a week in which the frailty of the American position in Iraq was evident in the departure of our key ally, or at least a reduction in the role of our key ally, Britain, in the use of new weapons by the insurgency in Baghdad. These chlorine bombs, right, I think, prefigure something that I fear is ahead, which is the use of weapons that will cause massive casualties, probably directed at the Green Zone. I think the insurgents must imagine that they can have a kind of 9/11 event in the Green Zone with great loss of life, something equivalent to the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, that would really break American political will once and for all. And I worry that the chlorine bombs, we saw this last week, the attacks on helicopters, which, as we remember, had a deadly effect on the Russians in Afghanistan. You know, I've been to Iraq many, many times and flown all over the country in helicopters. If you begin to ground helicopters, if they're really vulnerable, it would be very hard to sustain the American presence as it's been. So this was a week that showed just how tough this is going to be for the Bush administration.
Senate Democrats this week, David, as you know, drafting a plan to take back authority that Congress granted President Bush for the war in Iraq. Senator Joe Biden of Delaware stressed his experience in this clip that you're about to hear and said he's proposing a measure to end Bush's authority to wage war in Iraq.
I have legislation now that I'm trying to sell to my colleagues with Carl Levin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, where we revoke the president's authority that he was given under the authority to go to war. And we redefine it.
Jill Lawrence, what are the chances of that happening?
Well, that's unclear at the moment, but I think that the timing of the Blair announcement certainly kind of gave a little wind to the sails of the Democrats as they try to do this. There is some sense that this is a better way to go than capping funds or tying the hands of military commanders. And it's if you read the original resolution, things certainly are different now than they were then. So there's a substantive reason to reauthorize perhaps the U.S. role in Iraq in a different way. So this may gather some steam. It certainly was popular at the forum. Bill Richardson, who's a former U.N. ambassador, said he supported the same thing. And I think, you know, it's going to put a lot of Democrats on the spot, particularly those who want to be president and be commander-in-chief. Do you want to change the authority, limit the authority, reassert the role of Congress?
David Ignatius, I want to come back to you and talk about your top story this week, which was Iran. This week, Russia and China saying they're on board for another resolution condemning Iran. With all the United States foreign policy missteps, is there progress when it comes to this particular issue?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I quoted Nicholas Burns, who's the Undersecretary of State, who's been responsible, really, for the Iran negotiations, saying that Russia and China are on board. We'll have to see. He'll go to London on Monday and try to hammer out the details. I would be surprised if he'd made a comment like that without having good reason. If we can keep that coalition together, and you know, the Bush administration so often is attacked for being unilateral on Iran, they really have tried very hard to keep a coalition that includes Russia intact. And if they can continue to do that, there is some reason to think that it's going to bear fruit. When I was in Iran in August and September, I had many Iranians tell me, well, we're not so worried about the American threats and the sanctions because Russia won't go along with that. Well, guess what? Russia did go along with it. Mm. And if Russia will re-up for a second round of sanctions, even if they remain fairly mild, I think that's really going to concern the Iranians. The Iranians have been sending emissaries all over, including to Moscow. And I think this is a sign that they really do fear that they're getting more isolated than they expected. Their firebrand president Ahmadinejad is increasingly vulnerable politically at home. So I think there are reasons to think that in this area at least, an American policy that is very multilateral and is more restrained than some of the headlines here might suggest is working. Mm.
David, thank you. I want to turn to the phones for a moment. Mary is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Mary, hello. You're on the line.
Thank you. I hear all these stories you're telling, but these stories don't matter. The only story that really mattered this whole week was at the story about Walter Reed Hospital, how the veterans and the enlisted men who are wounded and brain damaged are being abused, living in Building 18, along with the rats and the roaches, sleeping on World War II mattresses.
Mary, thank you for that call. Jack Beatty, I know this has been an important story for you this week as well.
Yes, and thank you, Mary, for bringing that up. You know, throughout the debate in the Senate on the surge resolution, people kept saying, support our troops. You know, you got to show that you support the troops. And if you're against this resolution, if you're against the surge, you don't support the troops. Well, here's how the troops are being supported at this facility, outpatient facility at Walter Reed. Let me just read the first paragraph of this outstanding story by Dana Priest and Ann Hull in the Washington Post. Behind the door of Army Specialist Jeremy Duncan's room, part of the wall is torn and hangs in the air, weighted down with black mold. When the wounded combat engineer stands in his shower and looks up, he can see the bathtub on the floor above through a rotted hole. The entire building, constructed between the world wars, often smells like greasy takeout. Signs of neglect are everywhere. Mouse droppings, belly-up cockroaches, stained carpets, cheap mattresses. And it goes on and on. This facility is 5 miles from the White House. 700 soldiers in and out of this catchment place, some for as long as 10 months, waiting while they're being so-called rehabilitated from their injuries. But I think perhaps the real scandal here is they're being held by the Army because the Army is so desperate to keep its numbers up that the Army wants to make sure whether they can get any more mileage out of people who've had brain injuries, who've had trauma, who've lost organs, some of them. There have been suicide attempts. And it goes on and on. It's an outstanding piece, and I think it's the kind of thing, and it fits into a course that isn't alone. Danny Zwerdling on NPR last year did a piece about Fort Collins, Colorado, where
psychiatric care there where
soldiers were being harassed by the commander, did not believe there was such a thing as post-traumatic stress disorder. They were being called malingerers. They were close to suicide. If it were 1914 and people had never heard of shell shock, you could understand it. But you know, there's a whole tradition of medicine, and this fort commander and the sergeant simply wouldn't grant that there can be psychiatric consequences to this horrific war. Anyway, this is what's happening to the soldiers in some of the facilities.
Jack Beatty, thank you. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Sarah is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Sarah, hello to you.
Hello, and thank you. Wonderful program, as always. My concern this week was what's happening with this man, Scooter Libby. I cannot understand what he is being really accused of. I mean, a cover-up? Is he covering up for the administration for something? I know it has to do with Wilson and Valerie Plame, but I cannot understand. It sounds to me as if he is being a scapegoat for something or somebody. that somebody else should take the blame.
Sarah, thank you. Let me turn to Jill Lawrence, USA Today. Jill, a Scooter Libby, a scapegoat. What's your take on the trial?
Well, I was afraid you were going to come to me on this one, and I think I'm about as confused as anybody else about it. It's one of those stories that just seems to be of endless fascination inside Washington, and I guess to a few people outside Washington. And, you know, the thing that he's being accused of is lying, and he's not even the person who notified reporters of this, who first notified people about Valerie Plame and what she did. So, you know, obviously there's a lot of suspicions about what Vice President Cheney's role was and who's really at the bottom of this. And there's been a lot of press interest because, let's face it, our own colleagues were on the stand having to defend the way they do their jobs.
Yes.
And deal with their sources. So that's been kind of a gossip fest for reporters. And but I've got to say, I don't know that we'll ever know what really happened and, you know, what everyone's motivations were. And the other thing you have to also remember is that people don't remember things. And so everyone's got different memories of who said what to who when. And, you know, they don't always jive. And I think this is going to be one of these situations without a resolution except for what happens with the jury.
You know,
Jack Beatty, go ahead.
In his statement to the jury, prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, had it right when he said this, quote, casts a cloud over the White House and especially over the vice president. Because, of course, again and again in the testimony, we've heard how he was urging them to get this story out to discredit Wilson. And why? Because Wilson had blown the whistle on the central deception, and I'm using that word carefully, the central deception upon which the intervention in Iraq was based, namely that Saddam was reconstituting his nuclear weapons, and no one was more identified with that deception than Vice President Cheney. So I think that quite apart from the legal issues involved, that is the political take on this, that this is, in fact, a cloud over the White House.
David Ignatius, Washington Post, you agree?
Yeah, I think this trial is about one thing that's simple and one thing that's very complicated. The simple thing is what Jill said. It's about whether Libby lied. And a lot of evidence has been presented that the story that he told the prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, was a lie. That he asserted that he'd heard about the covert status of Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, from a journalist, Tim Russert of NBC News. It was contradicted by so many pieces of evidence that have been introduced in the trial. If you read this trial record, it is a very powerful case. The larger issue it's about is, I think, the war that was going on between Vice President Cheney's office and the CIA over intelligence about Iraq and Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, about the case that was used to take the country to war. It's a big issue. It really matters. And again, if you go carefully through the evidence that's been introduced in the trial, I believe you find a pretty convincing case that Cheney's office was at war with the CIA, that they regarded it as damning that a CIA officer, Valerie Plame, might have instigated this trip, in part because they thought they discredited it.
Here are a couple more stories that made headlines this week. In Florida, they're calling her the miracle baby. After 4 months in an incubator, Amelia Sonia Taylor came home. She was born 5 months premature and weighed just 10 ounces at birth. Her doctor said nothing short of a miracle.
There has been no known survivor born this early to ever go home. And not only is the baby going home, the baby is thriving and doing well.
Also, for the first time, Wimbledon will serve up equal prize money for men and women. The exact amount will be announced in April. Tim Phillips, chairman of the All English Club, called it a win-win-win situation.
We think whichever way you look at this, the players will recognise this as a good step forward, and we think it's a good step forward for Wimbledon and for the club. And we do think as well, it's a broader perspective, it's a good news story as far as the rest of tennis is concerned.
Our guests this hour are Jill Lawrence, national political correspondent for USA Today, David Ignatius, columnist at The Washington Post, and of course, as always, our own Jack Beatty. I want to turn for a moment to JetBlue. They had a difficult week. They go on the apology offensive, reeling from operational stumbles, printed an online apology, video apologies, email apologies, apologies all over the place. CEO David Neeleman introduced a new customer rights, Bill of Rights, following a round of canceled and delayed flights that left customers livid.
We don't set out in the morning to think of ways that we can make people's lives miserable, because we know if we did that, people wouldn't come and fly us again. So we have our interests of our customers in mind to begin with, and we don't need Washington to tell us how to treat our customers. And because of that, we're going to come out with our own Bill of Rights, and we'll keep adding to it.
Jill Lawrence, could the airline's meltdown set off changes across the industry?
Well, I speak as a person who spent most of this past week on planes and also ended up last week staying an extra day in Michigan because of the weather after covering the Mitt Romney announcement. So I'm a consumer, and I think that probably it would take a crisis like this to make some changes. And look, people aren't going to stop flying, but they do have choices of airlines. So anything that that helps them streamline their procedures and just at least have communication systems in place to know what's going on the tarmac and know which people have been on planes and what the conditions are on planes after hours is, in my view, it couldn't happen too soon.
David Ignatius, could the Bill of Rights be actually a good thing, generally, broadly speaking, for travelers?
Well, it could be good PR. I mean, it's a shame that airlines can't check into rehab because that's about what JetBlue needs right now. You know, this is a ritual of apology after appalling behavior, whether by celebrities or airlines, is really beginning to gnaw on my nerves. That, you know, we have come to expect cheap air travel. And cheap air travel comes at a price, so to speak, and that price is reduced service. You know, JetBlue has been successful by offering more efficient, people thought, slimmed down corporate profile, but that left it absolutely unable to deal with this crisis. And I think it's symptomatic of the big problem in air travel, which is it's cheaper, but it's no fun for anybody.
Mm. Back to the phones, Aiken, South Carolina. Miranda is on the line. Miranda, hello to you.
Hi, good. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I was wondering, why is there so much coverage right now of an election, a presidential election, that is so far away when there are so many other topics that I would think would be of the national interest?
Good question, Miranda. Along those lines, Jill Lawrence, you brought up covering Mitt Romney this week. He has launched his first television campaign of the 2008 Republican primary. Here's an ad that's on the air in five states, including Iowa and New Hampshire. Here's an excerpt.
Mitt Romney, business legend, rescued the Olympics, the Republican governor who turned around a Democratic state.
Isn't it a little early, Jill Lawrence?
Well, it is early. We've already had our first major forum of the campaign. I think in the last cycle, it didn't happen until May. So we're at least 3 months ahead of schedule here. And I've heard both Democrats and Republicans say privately to me that one of the reasons for this is that people are very frustrated, angry, disgruntled, disappointed in whatever, however you want to describe it. They're waiting. They want the next administration in place. If they could do it tomorrow, they would. There's just unhappiness with the Bush administration all around. And so, you know, people are already focusing on their choice for the next administration, and there's open it's an open race on both sides. There's no heir apparent, and that hasn't been true for decades and decades, something like 80 years. So there's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of competition, and thus we have Mitt Romney already on the air almost a year before the first primaries happen. And he is an interesting guy, a Mormon who was the governor of Massachusetts and is now making a pitch for Christian conservatives who he hadn't seen eye to eye with, social conservatives. So, and he's pitching himself as a business executive, a guy who saved the Olympics, trying to get his own definition of himself out there before some of these attacks on him take hold.
Jack Beatty, is that viable? Do you agree with that?
Well, he's got a hard task. It keeps coming out over the weekend. He had an interview with George Stephanopoulos, positions he's taken in the past that are coming back to haunt him. For example, he supported Paul Tsongas in 1992 in the Democratic primary. Has to talk about that. He pledges himself to be a proud gun owner and a friend of the National Rifle Association. But wouldn't you know, he just joined the NRA last August. This is part of a pattern of sort of election conversion on the part of Mr. Romney to conservative positions. And I think it's raising real questions about him for conservative Republicans.
Back to the phones. Jay is calling from Fort Madison, Iowa. Jay, you're on the line.
Yeah, I really appreciate the show. And the answer to the question why it's so important to get this campaign stuff, they're going to choose it by February 6th. They've moved everything up so far. And the main point I want to make is this. They are trying, the right-leaning are trying to trash Edwards and Obama both. They can't pump up Hillary enough. And the only thing I agreed with was Geffen's whole screed, and it was over the top. There's one thing they can't get around. She is divisive. She'll never get more than 50-something percent, maybe 51%. I want a president that's going to be up in the upper 50s, maybe 60% of people agree. I'd even vote for McCain. And I'm going to be a caucus goer, and I'm supporting Edwards or Obama. I am not going to go with fighting these battles over again.
We hear you, Jay. Thank you. Thank you for your call. Alan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the line.
Yes, how are you? Jill, it's a pleasure to hear you. And my comment is that Bill Clinton would be a huge asset to Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. He's a winner, and it's a winning team. And the Democrats haven't had a winner since John F. Kennedy in 1960. Democrats can buy into a losing proposition, a candidate, or go with the winning Clinton team, and then take Obama or one of these guys for a running mate. I think anybody else will lose in November 08.
David Ignatius, do you want to tackle that?
Well, I think the one point I'd make is that, you know, we repeat over and over again, Hillary Clinton is a divisive figure. Hillary Clinton brings all this baggage. But, you know, I traveled with her in the fall campaign in upstate New York in traditionally Republican territory, in part because I was curious how she plays. I mean, is she as divisive as everybody says? And you know what? She has helped put the Democratic Party back together in New York in an amazing way. I mean, you know, she was a very effective campaigner in Republican areas of upstate New York, in Rochester and surrounding towns. And, you know, part of why she plays well is that she, on issues like health care that the country really cares about, she speaks in a very down-to-earth, practical way. You know, we think of the Clintons and fireworks and, you know, all these crazy scandals that surrounded them, but in truth, Hillary campaigns, I think, in a very direct way. So the one resolve I've made about this campaign early on is to avoid sort of received wisdom about the candidates, that Obama's a lightweight without experience, that Hillary's divisive. I mean, we have all year to watch this play out and make up our minds for ourselves. You know, what kind of people are they? What kind of presidents would they be?
Jill Lawrence, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in. I just make a couple of points. One is that Bill Clinton, yes, he won, but I don't think he ever reached 50%. He had third-party candidates taking part of the vote. And the other is that when Hillary Clinton runs in New York, it's a little bit different. He's not part of the equation. He's not back in the White House. It's just kind of a whole new level of magnitude. That's not to say that she wouldn't be a good candidate or doesn't campaign well. I've heard Democrats who are nervous about her say that, you know, Democrats in New York or Republicans in New York, independents in New York are different than these people in other states. So it may not be, you know, transferable to other states, but we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and her negatives, according to the paper this morning, are rising in New York State just since the election. But, you know, to Alan's point, I mean, I really think that Bill Clinton is going to be baggage for her. I mean, my gosh, let's remember that this was the most ethically challenged administration, really, I think, since Nixon. And all of that is going to come back, and her part in some of it is going to come back. And I think the question for Democrats is, do you want to have a candidate who's going to have to fight all those other battles? Because the Republicans will do ad after ad about this very stuff. And, you know, Bill Clinton may have been a successful president, looked at competently, but you can't blink all the ethical issues, and Hillary is involved in them.
From Democrats to the GOP for a moment, several Republican presidential candidates spoke this week at the National Convention of Religious Broadcasters in Orlando, Florida. Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas told them he'd be a defender of religious speech.
We ought to be able to have, yes, a separation of church and state, but not a removal of faith from the public square. Amen. Faith belongs in the public square.
Tony Perkins, president of the Family Religious Family Research Council, told the Associated Press that most religious broadcasters are not ready to commit to a candidate just yet.
This is the courtship period where we see candidates approaching with their positions, trying to garner support, and we'll let that run its course.
So what about those who haven't bothered to come?
Well, they obviously won't dance with us. If you don't dance, we're not going out for coffee afterwards.
Jill Lawrence, the courting of the religious right is still very important.
It is important, and there's several candidates who are doing it. One is former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, and then, of course, there's Senator Brownback from Kansas, and Senator John McCain, surprisingly, who's making a lot of overtures to the religious right, also Mitt Romney. So there is a lot of competition for these people. Now, it's interesting that the person who's leading most national polls is not making that play at all, and that's Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York. His positions on social issues don't jibe at all with those of Christian conservatives, social conservatives. So it's unclear whether security and terrorism concerns are going to trump social issues in the 2008 campaign. What is clear is that the Christian right is very well organized in Iowa and in some of the other early states. So they do have a lot of influence, and that's why there's so much competition for them.
Jack Beattie, I wanted to bring you in for a moment because I know an important story for you this week was former President Jimmy Carter's trip to Africa.
Oh, yeah. Nick Kristof, who just does such great work in the New York Times, had two columns about Carter's visits there. And Carter was there drawing attention to this horrifying illness. It goes along with river blindness. It's a mosquito-borne worm, 2 feet long, that gets into people and then pushes out through the skin. And Carter told how he was in a village where these worms were pushing out through the skin of little girls, and he said he just broke out and wept. And he said he couldn't watch the worms coming out of the nipple of a woman there. And he said, and then he talked about how little he hopes to be able, with even the little bit of money he has, and Merck has been very good on this, they're putting forward this drug, to be able to eradicate this disease. And he said to Kristof, said to him, Mr. President, suppose this were what American foreign policy were about, eradicating diseases around the world. Do you think that would be better for us than, say, the war in Iraq? And, suddenly you thought, well, of course, that sounds utopian and ridiculous, but just simply as a matter of realpolitik, I can't imagine anything that would help the American people and the American future better than, in fact, a foreign policy that said, yeah, we are going to stop these scourges of mankind and these horrifying things because we can.
Back to the phones now to let our listeners be heard before we wrap up our hour. Kathy is calling from Buford, South Carolina. Kathy, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What the last call person just said about Carter, who is he's the epitome of honesty. And I know his administration, his time was just such a disaster in so many ways. But there's such huge frustration with the dishonesty of this administration and previous administrations. But this has gotten to the all-time high. And when Jill Lawrence says that the people outside the Beltway aren't watching the Libby trial, that's dead wrong. We're watching everything. We're waiting for someone to come to the surface. Edwards is showing the most hope of being a true, consistent person who is out to help all people, not just the super rich. And certainly, if we could do like what Al Gore is doing and trying to bring people attention to the real needs and disease and poverty and the environment are where it's at, and waging wars under pretenses that are totally false. It's just not the way that we as Americans want to be. I mean, so many of us would rather be in another country at this point.
Kathy, thank you for your call. David Ignatius, Washington Post. Do you feel that frustration inside the Beltway and out?
Well, I think this is a time of real difficulty for the United States. I just came back from a trip that took me to the Middle East, and I have never in more than 25 years of traveling that part of the world seen people so angry at the United States to the point that, I mean, they're almost now giving up on our ability to do things right. You know, I should note that people outside the States, in the Middle East even, there's not a clamor for a quick U.S. departure from Iraq. I think there's a feeling that we made a mess there and we have a moral obligation to try to do what we can to stabilize it. But, you know, in general, I think people are deeply unhappy and frustrated with the United States. And that's, you know, that ought to be a central issue in this campaign. How is the next president going to try to restore some momentum to U.S. foreign policy?
David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post. He's also a novelist. His new book, Body of Lies, has been with us today from Washington. David, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Jill Lawrence joining us also from Washington, national political correspondent for USA Today. Jill, it's been great to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
And Jack Beatty, of course, is always joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, thanks again.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.